infection numbers across Europe.
Officials have made it clear that another year of recurring lockdowns is not an option. The hope is that with more vaccinations, that can be avoided. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
On International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, Gaza's health sector continues to suffer due to the Israeli blockade. Coronavirus infections have skyrocketed in the Gaza Strip, which is one of the world's most densely populated areas. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment. Human rights organizations say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
The Israeli blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, and especially on the health sector. The health sector is suffering from an unprecedented deterioration due to lack of medicines and medical supplies, as well as trained medical personnel to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver.
Our people are suffering because of the Zionist blockade under the watchful eye of the international community. The situation has only gotten worse amid the coronavirus pandemic.
As infections continue to rise, experts are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the coronavirus.
The humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is catastrophic and is getting worse by the day. The health sector is unable to provide proper medical care to coronavirus patients and even struggles to provide tests for the deadly virus. Gaza has a population of over 2 million and hospitals don't have enough beds for the patients.
The COVID-19 pandemic remains a serious concern due to the capacity gaps in the enclave's health system. Hospitals in the tiny enclave lack medical facilities and medicines to tackle the deadly virus due to years of Israeli blockade. Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health sector since 2007. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
More and more Yemeni civilians die in Yemen on a daily basis amid the continuation of the Saudi siege on the Arab country. Here in the Pediatric Leukemia Treatment Center, 50% of patients, namely children, die due to the lack of medicine and medical care they need to survive.
We've suffered a lot to establish this center so that children could have a chance to survive, especially due to the difficulties of traveling abroad. During the past 6 years, we received hundreds of cases, but the death rate is still high. And we hope that the concerned international organizations will do their role so the children could have a normal recovery.
Hundreds of children come to the center from all across Yemen, as it is the only medical center for such patients, hoping that they will receive the required treatment. However, the ongoing war and the crippling blockade have made the center suffer from a permanent shortage of medicines, medical supplies, and radiation devices.
The families of patients come from remote areas. They also face lack of medical supplies. Also, the treatment for leukemia is marrow transplantation, which is very expensive and is carried out outside the country, which is not possible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a's airport.
I come from Al-Mahwit Governorate, which is very far away, and we face a lot of trouble traveling to reach this center, which suffers from a constant shortage of medicines and overcrowding of patients, as it is the only center in Yemen.
The health sector in Yemen is in a dire need of necessary support from international and relief organizations, which have not played their role in alleviating the suffering of the Yemeni people that began in March 2015 due to the Saudi war on Yemen.
Hundreds of children lose their lives at the gates of the center due to the lack of medicines and other medical supplies, as well as their inability to travel for treatment due to its high costs and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It's been almost 1 year since the U.S. President Donald Trump ordered the assassination of head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The martyrdom of Haj Qasem, along with head of the Iraqi Popular Forces Haj Abu Mahdi Muhandis, has had a major impact on the region, and specifically Lebanon. The images on the streets of Beirut reflect the news which became general knowledge after his assassination. His role as a representative of the Islamic Republic of Iran in assisting the resistance was instrumental.
Even Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said this, that he was one of the fathers, the main fathers of the victory of the year 2006. And also what followed after that was the training and the equipment that the Islamic resistance got, that the Israelis are now quite fearsome of.
Hezbollah Secretary General has stressed in several speeches that the U.S. crime will not go without punishment, stressing that the martyrdom of Haj Qasem will only strengthen the resistance alliance.
We admit that it was a heavy blow to our resistance alliance. In this life, it was a loss for us, but God Almighty has kept the family and friends and beloved people of Haj Qasem Soleimani for us. Also, the blood of Haj Qasem Soleimani will strengthen and reinforce the path of resistance.
The leader of Al-Quds forces was seen as someone who united many fronts in the region against aggression.
Things are quite interrelated here in the region. You know, whatever happens in what country reflects on the other countries. So his role was quite major, and The act of the assassination that the Americans did was not only revenge of certain defeat, but also a revenge against the defeat of their brains by the brains of Martyr Soleimani.
In a gesture of gratitude, one of the municipalities in southern Beirut named one of the streets after Martyr General Qasem Soleimani, whose name has become immortalized, but what many see here as the spirit of martyrdom.
The important thing that we need to focus on from these examples, from the martyrs that are sacrificing themselves, that our ummah, our nation, is always capable of producing more, and people who have the same spirits. Martyr Suleiman's legacy was quite huge, especially with the issue of the spirit of the martyr.
General Qasem Soleimani was not only seen as a friend of Lebanon, of the Lebanese resistance. He was considered by Hezbollah's commanders and leaders as a partner of the resistance, who played a key role in achieving liberation for Lebanon in the year 2000 and securing victory for Lebanon in the 2006 war. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Israeli warplanes have carried out a wide air raid targeting various positions in the besieged Gaza Strip in the early hours of Saturday. The Israeli airstrikes caused damages to hospitals, mosques, and agricultural lands in the east of the Strip, and two civilians were reported injured. Israel claimed the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza.
Targeting civilians in industrial areas indicates that the Israeli army has been encouraged by the recent normalization deals with a number of Arab states to further violate Palestinian rights. But we will continue our resistance against Israeli aggression.
Resisting groups here stressed the Israeli army's crimes over Gaza and targeting civilians amount to violations of international law.
The Israeli army continues to commit crimes against our people. The airstrikes have frightened civilians and led to serious damages. We are facing a violent regime. The resistance, however, we respond in case the Israeli army continues its aggression. Resistance is our only weapon. We have to defend Palestinian rights. Netanyahu is trying to escape from his political impasse by stepping up pressure against us.
Palestinian groups say Israeli army should be held accountable for its crimes. Israeli occupation exacerbated the already dire condition Palestinians are living through, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The airstrikes violate all international laws because Israeli army targets hospitals and residential areas. We hold the Israeli occupation responsible for all the consequences of this aggression.
The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing rocket fire from the enclave. Palestinians here say that Israeli army violates all international laws by damaging hospitals and targeting civilians. They insist their resistance is the only way to cope with the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Resistance figures from Palestine, Syria, and Iraq have marked the first martyrdom anniversary of commander of Iran's Al-Quds force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in Damascus, recalling his role in restoring stability to Syria. In a gathering, resistance delegates underlined the importance of his efforts in leading resistance in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine.
General Soleimani exerted huge efforts to support Palestinians in Gaza and occupied territories. He had a great role in raising the morale of Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli aggression. He never interfered in the internal affairs of the Palestinians.
We have gathered here to pay tribute to two great leaders of resistance who lost their lives in fight against enemies of our causes. We tell those who want to create divisions among us that we will remain united and strong and will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani.
On the 3rd of January 2020, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered strikes that killed General Soleimani and his companions near Baghdad International Airport.
Martyr Soleimani led battles in Aleppo and eastern Syria as well as around Damascus. His presence had always boosted the morale of fighters. His presence scared the enemy on the battlefield and at the same time gave power to resistance fighters.
The role of Martyr Soleimani and the alliance of Iraqi, Iranian, and Syrian resistance gave a lesson to the U.S. and its allies that they can't defeat our resistance, especially in Syria and Iraq.
Throughout the war on Syria, the general was a top strategist and military commander, leading Iranian military advisors who helped Syria at its government's request in the fight against terrorists. He frequently visited the front lines in Aleppo and Deir ez-Zor and joined resistance fighters for advisement, despite knowing he was a target for the U.S. and its allies. The general also took personal command of the battle against Daesh terrorists in the city of Bukamal in Deir ez-Zor countryside in November 2017. For resistance fighters, he was a commander and a father. For Syrians, he was a true friend and a hero. For the Syrian army, he was a brother and an ally who was there whenever needed. And this is how Martyr Qasem Soleimani will be remembered in Syria. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei delivered on January 8, 2020, in a meeting with the people of the city of Qom. The meeting was held on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Shahid Soleimani would embrace danger, and he had no fears. His courage showed itself not only in recent events, but also during the Sacred Defense era, during which time he was the commander of the Tharallah army. Both he and his army showed exemplary courage, and he was a man of wisdom as well. he would think carefully, and he had reasons for his actions. This simultaneous courage and acumen manifested itself not only in the arena of the military, but also in the arena of politics. I said this many times to the friends active in the arena of politics, as we were witness to his behavior and his actions. He was courageous and wise in the arena of politics as well. His words would exert tremendous influence, and they were convincing. Above all, he was pure and sincere. He would expend his courage and acumen on the path of God, and he was not a hypocrite and a pretentious man.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Sincerity is very important. We should practice sincerity as well. Another one of his qualities was that despite being a commander who had mastery over the military, he was very careful to observe Shari'i principles. Sometimes, people forget about Shari'i principles in the arena of war, saying that there's no time for that. But he was very careful in this regard. He would not use weapons if he did not deem it necessary. He would take care not to transgress against other people's rights. He would exercise caution in areas that people do not deem necessary, but he would try to be cautious. He would embrace danger, but at the same time, he would protect others' lives as far as he could. He would watch over the lives of his comrades, his soldiers, and his colleagues from among other nations who stood beside him. الحمد لله الحمد لله All praises to Allah All praises to Allah الحمد لله الحمد لله All praises to Allah All praises to
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی. مسافرین گرامی، خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Nimitz operated in the Persian Gulf for 2 months until early November. That's the longest time that a U.S. aircraft carrier has spent in this region since 2018. An Israeli submarine headed for the same region, coinciding with a sighting of submarine USS Georgia. On December 9, two American B-52 bombers headed for the Persian Gulf, accompanied by Saudi aircraft. All this ahead of the first anniversary of the assassination of Iran's senior commander, Soleimani, in a U.S. drone attack near Baghdad Airport. What's the widespread deployment for? Would this stabilize the Middle East region or stir the situation? Now let's go to Washington, D.C. to our correspondent, Colin Campbell. There, Colin, tell us about how the media has been covering this and reactions to this.
Well, to answer your first question, I would say not very much at all, to be honest. We're really focused a lot here on COVID-19 and the rise of the number of Americans who are dying from a pandemic that the government did not responsibly respond to. But as far as other elements of media that are covering this event, there are some that are speculating as to why there is such a buildup of the Navy in around the Strait of Hormuz, and that could be to send a sign to Iran for some reason or another as we battle also with a transition of power here in the country. We have a president who seems very reluctant to relinquish power to the incoming president-elect Biden. But of course, the real difference will happen on January 20th. That's really the day that the president-elect will be inaugurated. But along the way, it doesn't seem like the current president wants to give in to that or accept the terms of the election. So meanwhile, he's building up the Navy in this region, along with his leaders in foreign policy, to show a sign to Iran that we're still very active in that region. And so if there's any type of aggression that is directed towards the U.S., now is not the time to do it. But again, that's mere conjecture. We're not really sure exactly why there is such a buildup there. We do know that it's the first time in decades that so many members of the Navy have gone there, especially when you see these types of posturing with the USS Georgia going through the Strait of Hormuz, accompanied by other submarines, which pack a lot of firepower. And one has to imagine that this is just something as an act of intimidation, perhaps, or an implicit type of threat that is supposed to be taken as an implication of potential provocation if there is a feeling of being threatened by Iran towards the U.S.
Okay, I got to apologize for the technical glitch that happened in the live show. It's natural. So I got to thank our correspondent, Colin Campbell, who joined us from Washington, D.C., and told us about the reactions of the media and also relevant to stories. Now, I'll be joined by national security analyst and political commentator Brian Downing out of Florida. Brian, good to have you with us. General Kenneth McKenzie, Jr., who heads the U.S. Central Command, says the deployment is an example of Washington-Tel Aviv's what it calls a strong working relationship and shared commitment to regional security and stability. Is this in good faith?
Well, it could be seen as simply signaling that there's not a war coming, that there is not an attack coming. I've been very skeptical of these wars imminent scenarios for many, many years. It doesn't mean I'll be correct this time. But I don't think there is going to be an attack. I think Trump is really just posturing, signaling, preening, beating his breast. I don't think he's going to do it. I don't think the generals want to do it. The generals and admirals don't want it. They have priorities elsewhere. They have been stuck in wars in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan for up to 20 years now. They see bigger fish in the geopolitical world out there. They would, if they were given an order today or in the next few days to attack Iran, I think they would say, well, we don't have enough assets in the area. And they probably do, but they'll still say that. And the United States has had more assets in the Persian Gulf than they have right now. I think they'll say they have to consult our allies. They may even pull the MasterCard and say, we have to consult Congress. That would certainly be a first in American foreign policy in quite a while. I just don't think that there is a war coming. could be wrong this time, but that's my view.
Okay. Now, from San Francisco, we have Richard Becker, who is with the Answer Coalition, also joining us. Good to have you with us, Richard. Some observers argue that the recent military deployments by Israel, the U.S., and Saudi Arabia aim to dissuade Iran from responding to the killing of its nuclear scientists, Fakhrizadeh. Let's have your take on that.
Well, I think that the situation is a dangerous situation that exists now. And the fact that nuclear weapon-equipped ships are being sent into the region, not that they're not there a lot, but that they're very openly saying, you know, we're coming in, they don't usually, the Navy doesn't usually announce ahead of time, or many times they don't announce at all, where they have deployed nuclear weapons carrying equipment, ships, but they did this time. And your other guest may be right that this may be a show of force. I certainly hope that it is. The weaponry, though, that's deployed there is enough to not only destroy Iran, pretty much they're able to destroy the world. And, you know, there has been, over the last 70 years, there have been many, many close calls to the use of nuclear weapons. Some of them are completely unintentional. Some of them based on, you know, misreading the skies. That almost happened. And so, you know, any time that you take this weaponry out and you deploy it, and it's deployed all over the seas, all over the world, particularly the U.S. Navy with its nuclear weapon ships, it runs a risk. So I don't think that the Iranian government has any interest at all in war, of course, and has to really take into account the fact that they're seeing this deployment. And it's not only the U.S., but Israel, which has, I believe, recently become nuclear weapons equipped with its submarines through the aid of Germany, has also deployed into the region. So it's there's a huge deployment of military force there. It constitutes a danger, and the U.S. acts here and through the corporate media here as if Iran is doing the provocation, when in fact this is clearly a provocation by the United States and Israel.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brian, since November, Tel Aviv has put its embassies on high alert, and also Richard mentioned, it's also dispatched a submarine to the Persian Gulf. Are these the right moves? What could be behind this?
Well, I think a lot of embassies are on alert around the Middle East, American, Saudi, just about all of them. I think the weapon to look at would be the massive order, the targets to look at would be the nuclear uranium enrichment plants at Natanz and Bordeaux. They're about, I think, 100 miles south of Tehran. Well, they're very difficult targets. You're not going to damage them with cruise missiles or conventional ordnance. They are most susceptible to something called the massive ordnance penetrator, which is a huge bomb that burrows very deep into the ground. The Natanz facility is under about 300 feet of bedrock, and Bordeaux is burrowed into a mountain. They're very difficult targets. They would be the most highly desired targets from Israel's perspective and the neoconservative perspective. Where they can fly from the United States. They can go on B-2 Spirit bombers that would fly off from New Mexico and or Missouri. They can be refueled over along the way. I just don't think it's going to happen. I think it's posturing, and I think, as the previous guest said, signaling Iran that it should not retaliate robustly for the assassination of the nuclear scientists. Trump may want to just leave the region in a mess for Biden. I just don't think so. I think we're dealing here with smoke and mirrors, sound and fury. We've seen it before.
Yeah, Brian, Richard mentioned, Brian mentioned something many of our other experts I've talked to also mentioned the same thing, that this is the last days of President Trump at the Oval Office, and he's doing certain things, and he may want to, as other guests said, to leave the region in a mess. Something for a president like Joe Biden to go ahead with and try to tackle. What's your opinion?
Well, I think that it's clear that Trump is highly in a highly erratic state. I mean, usually is more so than usual. I think that it's possible that he could order some kind of action. I think that I don't think that the military commanders are looking for that. And the reason that I think they're not looking for it is not that they wouldn't like to bring down Iran and bring down the government in Iran. Iran's a large country with a large population. It's quite developed and so forth. But at the same time, the national security strategy of the United States, which was adopted, the most recent one, I believe it was in December 2017, said that the main item on the agenda, theater of conflict would be with really China and Russia. That it talked about major party conflict. You can't take that any other way, and Iran is not a major power in that regard. Iran does not have nuclear weapons. China and Russia do. China is really seen as the number one problem by the U.S. ruling elite. In that they see China as overtaking the U.S. in different ways, economically, and not militarily, certainly, but politically in terms of its influence around the world. So that's really, and you can see both from all of the advisors around Biden, as well as Trump, that they see China as their main enemy in the coming period. But I have to say again that the deployment of so much military force, if you look down through the history, you can see, I was actually just looking at it today, the photos of the collisions that have taken place between warships and the possibility that collisions could cause a nuclear disaster. There's no question that that can happen. And the war sometimes happens without either side intending war to happen. They climb the escalation ladder, as it's called, step by step, but end up somewhere where neither side perhaps wanted to be at the beginning. So this kind of war gaming, if that's what it is really hazardous.
Okay. Brian, let's take a look at another aspect of the story. Iran has offered the Hormuz Peace Initiative to Arab states, the Persian Gulf littoral states, while Tel Aviv has tried to forge relations with them, especially under this of U.S. brokered so-called normalization deals, and that's on shared concerns about Iran. So who's assumed a destabilizing role in West Asia?
Well, I would say that the Sunni powers have really begun a lot of this out of dynastic ambitions by the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and out of religious hatred. Well, that's their view. I just hate to see the United States dragged into this, into their prejudicial programs. If I were to embark on a policy of making America great again, to coin a phrase, I don't think I'd want to be led around the Middle East by the nose by Saudi Arabia and other powers. You cannot be a great power if you're just so easily manipulated by these people. Not the way to be a great power.
Mm-hmm. Richard, let's have your comment on the same question.
I don't think that the U.S. is really being led around exactly. I think that this is the decisions that are being made in Washington, and decisions that include the shipment now of huge amounts of new weaponry to Saudi Arabia to use against the people in Yemen, where half the population is in danger of starvation. This is the relationship with Saudi Arabia, Biden may be a little bit more critical of it, but it's not gonna break up the relationship. This is a long-standing relationship. Saudi Arabia really exists as a country because of the U.S. and Britain helped to bring one family to power. And it's been there for a long time, and the vast amounts of oil and the hundreds of billions, really it's trillions and trillions of dollars now in wealth that has originated from Saudi Arabia and ended up in the banks of New York, and particularly New York and London and so forth. So this is, it's a very important relationship, and U.S. policy over the last 75 years, almost 75 years now, has been, once they got out of World War II and set up the CIA and embarked on a whole course of empire on a much wider scale, has been to prevent any independent powers in the Middle East that aren't willing to toe Washington's line. That's the real history. If you really look at it in the overview, so nationalist governments, mass movements, socialist movements, communist movements, progressive movements of all kinds have been seen as the problem from Washington's point of view. And I think that goes for Yemen today as well. It goes for all the forces in the region which aren't bowing before Washington. And then the aim is to crush them.
Now, Brian, let's take a look at the U.S. military presence and deployment in different parts of the world. Can you cite a spot on planet where U.S. military deployment has restored peace and security, as the climate, the record in countries in this part of the world, including Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, tells you otherwise?
Quick answer there is no. I would have to go back to World War II when I think American policy stabilized Central Europe and East Asia. But other than that, I think the wars in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, not so much Afghanistan since the troubles sort of predated the American presence there. But I think it's just led to chaos, havens for Al-Qaeda, resentment resentments against the United States in the region, and stress between the United States and longstanding allies in Europe and Asia. You know, to go back to that phrase, making America great again, American greatness was always based on strong alliances, and Donald Trump doesn't know that, and Joe Biden is going to have to repatch things in the next few years, which I think he can do. I think those countries want a strong America on their side. I'm talking about Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and East Asia, not so much the Middle East. But no, Trump has just shown no knowledge of foreign policy, alliances, history. He's an arrogant, erratic person, and happily he'll be gone in a few weeks without doing more damage.
Okay. Richard, what's the right way toward restoration of calm and tranquility to West Asia region? Military deployments or dialogue and diplomacy?
Well, it's clear, I think, and I would agree with David Gertz about this, is that it's created the military strategy, the strategy that's been carried out. And I do have to say, though, it's not just Trump, but it's all the recent administrations have thought that they could solve the problems mainly through military deployment. And the reality is that it has just created conditions that are abhorrent to so many people in the region. I mean, Syria is torn apart, Iraq is torn apart, Libya is torn apart, Yemen is torn apart. The result of the U.S. intervention has nothing to do with democracy, or wasn't motivated by democracy or human rights. All you have to do is look at Saudi Arabia and look at that relationship and then try to say, oh, the United States government, various administrations have been concerned about human rights in the region. I mean, so that's a terrible joke for the people who live in Saudi Arabia. But the reality is that whatever the tactics have been up until now, they have just created more and more suffering for people in the Middle East. And really, the United States needs to be out of the Middle East.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. From the Answer Coalition, we had Richard Becker out of San Francisco, a national security analyst and political commentator. Brian Downing joined us from Florida.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Donald Trump suffered fresh humiliation on Monday when more than 100 Republicans joined Democrats in the House of Representatives to override his veto of a $741 billion defense bill. If, as expected, the Senate follows suit later this week, it will be Congress's first such rebuke of his presidency, which has only 3 weeks left to run. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist David Smith. The piece is titled, House Republicans Join with Democrats to Override Trump's Veto of Defense Bill. Stay with us for more of David Smith's article. U.S. President Donald Trump suffered fresh humiliation on Monday when more than 100 Republicans joined Democrats in the House of Representatives to override his veto of a $741 billion defense bill. If, as expected, the Senate follows suit later this week, it will be Congress's first such rebuke of his presidency, which has only 3 weeks left to run. During a high-stakes day on Capitol Hill, the democratically controlled House of Representatives also voted to boost coronavirus relief payments to $2,000 per person. This was a step endorsed by Donald Trump, but is thought unlikely to progress in the Senate. The National Defense Authorization Act, which funds service members' pay, oversees military operations and other needs, has been passed by Congress every year since 1967. Donald Trump exercised his veto last week, returning the bill with objections, including his proposal to change the names of 10 military bases honoring Confederate leaders. Donald Trump was also aggrieved that the legislation did not repeal Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which protects technology companies from legal liability over content posted by their users. The president has accused Facebook and Twitter of political bias against him. Donald Trump's objections served as the latest loyalty test for Republicans in the aftermath of his election defeat by Joe Biden. Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, announced that he would not vote to override Donald Trump's veto despite supporting the original bill, which passed both chambers of Congress with strong bipartisan backing. But it was not enough. Some 109 Republicans broke with Donald Trump on Monday and joined Democrats to support the bill. The final tally of 322-87 comfortably reached the two-thirds threshold required to override President Donald Trump's veto. Mac Thornberry, the most senior Republican in the House of Representatives Armed Services Committee, urged his colleagues who had supported the bill earlier this month to back it again. "It's the exact same bill. Not a comma has changed," he said. "I would only ask that as members vote, they put the best interests of the country first. There is no other consideration that should matter." Democrat Adam Smith, chair of the committee, said, "It is enormously important that we pass this bill. We did it once. Let's just do it one more time, and then we can all go home for the year. We can be done, and we can be proud of what we have accomplished." The defense bill is expected to go before the Republican-controlled Senate later this week. It will become law if passed with a two-thirds majority. Donald Trump has exercised the veto 9 times during his presidency, but this would be the first override by Congress. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, expressed gratitude that Trump's dangerous sabotage efforts had been thwarted. "The president must end his 11th-hour campaign of chaos and stop using his final moments in office to obstruct bipartisan and bicameral action to protect our military and defend our security," Nancy Pelosi said. But activists found little consolation in the Republican defiance. Mary Small, Indivisible's acting national policy director, said, "This is no cause for celebration. It's sad and infuriating that the only time Republicans banded together to rebuke Donald Trump was in pursuit of an over-militarized foreign policy and bloated defense budget, and not any of the other horrifying, democracy-destroying, cruel things that he has done." Donald Trump blindsided Republicans again last week when he initially refused to sign a $2.3 trillion government funding and coronavirus relief package that had taken Congress months to negotiate. Trump eventually relented on Sunday night at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, averting a government shutdown. Donald Trump had demanded direct stimulus payments to U.S. citizens be increased to $2,000 as opposed to the agreed $600. On Monday, the House of Representatives voted 275-134 in favor of the higher sum, with 44 Republicans joining Democrats. But it is not certain whether it will even be taken up by the Senate, where again many Republicans would find themselves in the uncomfortable position of crossing Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders, an independent senator from Vermont, said, "The House has passed a $2,000 direct payment for working people. It is time for the Senate to act. This week on the Senate floor, Mitch McConnell wants to vote to override Trump's veto of the $740 billion defense funding bill and then head home for the new year. I'm going to object until we get a vote on legislation to provide a $2,000 direct payment to the working class." Bernie Sanders, a former candidate in the Democratic presidential primary, added, "Let me be clear, if Senator Mitch McConnell doesn't agree to an up or down vote to provide the working people of our country a $2,000 direct payment, Congress will not be going home for New Year's Eve. Let's do our job."
Bountiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English.